So we'll talk today about a causal developmental theory of representational content. It is a specific theory, what I have called the best test theory, developed by myself in the tradition of an American philosopher, Fred Dretske. So about halfway through the talk today, about halfway through the lecture, I'll say a bit about Dretske's approach and how it stands there in the background of my own. This can be somewhat technical at points, more so than most of the lectures. And so I'll try to take it slow. More than anything, I would like to convey the general idea of how philosophers have attempted to assign meaning to the mechanisms that are active in cognition and controlling thought processes and responses to the environment. The general project that philosophers have been engaged in is sometimes called the naturalization of intentionality. So the directedness of thoughts toward objects is a central feature of our mental lives. Developing a naturalistic theory of mental representation is one way to account for such directedness, also known as intentionality, a way that fits that directedness into the natural order. A comment on intentionality, this is not, this word is not in this context meant to convey anything about the subject's doing something on purpose. So an intention is often thought of as something that comes to the mind when one is planning and one is intending to do something. What this use of intentionality has in common with that other use is that they both involve something very vaguely like a goal or an object. But here it's simply the object of thought, the idea that when I think about the ocean, that the ocean is the object of my thought. And that relationship is itself a bit puzzling if one thinks in kind of contemporary scientific terms about the world as a physical system. Representation does not seem to be a physical relation in contrast to being on top of or being heavier than. And you could make those more technical and use predicates from physics or chemistry. But the idea is that representation seems a bit sort of mysterious in contrast to these physical measures. So the question is whether it can be fit into a broadly materialistic view of the universe. And if so, how so? So I'd like to mention a couple of preliminary thoughts that to set the stage for the presentation of the theory itself. One thing I'll do is bracket the representation of non-existent entities. So Santa Claus, unicorns, round squares, things that don't exist. Those are in some ways the harder cases. How can there be a physical relation between the subject and something that does not exist? That is especially puzzling. But the idea is that if representation can be naturalized for representations of properties that appear in our environment, we can hope for a combinatorial solution to the problem of representing uninstantiated properties or non-existent individuals. So round and square, for example, are two properties that may be present in our environment. So long as the mind or the cognitive system has the capability of compounding representations, that can explain how it is that the mind seems to think about round squares, even if they don't exist. But first we need a theory of how the mind could, the cognitive system could represent properties, individuals, kinds that are present in the environment. Preliminary number two. Now, as those who attended Monday's lecture will know, I favor the elimination of a personal level. And so we'll freely talk about what might be taken to be subpersonal representations. But even if there is a personal level, it is a promising naturalistic strategy to ground personal level intentional facts in the contents of subpersonal representations. If one thinks at the personal level, if there is a personal level, one thinks that whales are mammals, a plausible requirement for being in that personal level state is that one has subpersonal representations of whales and of mammals, involved, for example, in the visual recognition of members of those categories, where visual recognition happens very quickly by mechanisms we are not aware of. There will need to be representations of whales, mammals, features of those objects. And so even to explain conscious experience or personal level experience, if you think that falls at a different level, there will still be the requisite input from or contribution by subpersonal level representations. And so we want to have a theory of representational content for those. Of course, when all's said and done, on my view, we won't have a personal level at all. We'll have a bunch of different facts about the cognitive system, including facts about consciousness that are all interesting facts, but don't appear at different levels. And so it may be that one theory of content will satisfy all of our goals. Preliminary number three. It is sometimes claimed that personal level thought content is grounded in language use and socialization. And this is a big issue, grand issue. It's been discussed for decades. I won't be able to do it justice here, but I want to make a few remarks about it. The idea deriving from the work of Wittgenstein gives independent power to socially determined linguistic norms. And in this context, it's relevant. Some people think it's relevant because it seems to place all of the emphasis on social practice, that can determine the use of language, and that language can then determine the use of, determine the content of our thoughts. But somehow thought content is derived from language. That's the real alternative picture that is in the background that I'm pointing to here. This is, it's different from the idea that language use is a window into our cognitive system. I think that is a common view in cognitive linguistics, that examining language use can give us an understanding of the way cognition works more generally, the principles of thought more generally. And that may well be true, that is consistent with what I say today, but this Wittgensteinian view does not seem to be consistent with what I am presenting today. According to the Wittgensteinian view, all content derives from social practice. And so looking for something like a physical relation between clusters of neurons firing in the brain and members of kinds or property instances in the environment, this would all be very wrongheaded, according to Wittgenstein and his followers, or anyone who places language use first and foremost as the determinant of content might be worried about this. So I want to say something here in a slide or two about why I will not pursue that approach. One version of this argument holds that there is a right and a wrong way to use language. Language use is normative. Also, that meaning is determined by use. That's where kind of meaning comes from, just by the use of the language. Now, that's determined socially, as I've already said, by social correction, which is the only available process of establishing and enforcing correct and incorrect use. On this view, then, social practice determines the content of language. Now, as far as that goes, it's not obviously inconsistent with what I am going to be saying today. But if one takes the further step and says that mental content derives from language, then one gets a picture that is at odds with my picture. It's important to notice, though, something that Wittgenstein did not want to pay much attention to, and that some of his contemporaries also did not want to pay much attention to, which is internal cognitive processing. They tended toward behaviorism. they tended to focus on a personal level. Gilbert Ryle is one of the famous philosophers from this period who focused on the personal level and wanted to isolate it from talk about cognition or any mental processes of the sort scientists might study. But what's being ignored here is that such phenomena as language use and socialization are themselves best explained by the deployment of subpersonal representations, of acoustical properties of the incoming speech stream, for example, and of fast subpersonal representations of social dynamics and representation of the expectations of conspecifics. You might have seen on the previous slide, this argument that I presented presupposed that, or simply asserted that, social practice is the source of correction for the individual. But for that to be true, the individual must be able to detect and respond to social correction. The subject must have representations of the social environment, the expectations of conspecifics as other people. They must be able to process the properties of the speech stream. There's a kind of a magical way for social practice to influence the individual and serve as a corrective force. That has to be carried out. That process has to be effective in some way. And I think the machinery that must be presupposed in order for social correction to be effective, that machinery itself must be addressed. So what Wittgenstein didn't offer is a scientific account of how the individual's language use could be affected or controlled by social factors. Such a scientific account would seem to require positing typically subpersonal representations. But once that account has been worked out, then we have a theory of content. It might seem as if we have all the content that we need. We have a theory for subpersonal representations, and we don't need social practice and conformity in order to explain language use in the individual. And we certainly don't, and maybe this is the more important point, we don't need to make mental content derivative from social practice, because in order to explain our response to social practice, we already had to put content in the head by giving a theory of content for the subpersonal representations necessary to explain how we could respond to social practice or observe social practice or track and be sensitive to social practice. So it's very important to look at language use. Ultimately, it's one of the most interesting phenomena in human experience and human life. And it may, as I mentioned earlier, reflect very much about our cognitive processing. But one must give an account of how language comes to be used at all, how it's learned, how it's processed. And that account will require positing representations, so it would seem to. And that provides an avenue for content to enter into the mind or to appear in the cognitive system. We don't need to say, oh, it all comes from language, because in order to explain how anyone uses language, we've already had to bring content into the cognitive system. So what I'll do now is give you a picture of one approach to naturalistic semantics, the attempt to bring content into the cognitive system by something like a scientific or physical or natural relation between the subject and his or her environment. So I have called this the best test theory, and it's built on one basic principle, and this is what we'll focus on primarily. The principle is a bit wordy, and I will take a couple of slides afterwards to try to make sure what it entails is clear. Here is the principle. If a subject S bears no content-fixing intentions toward R, that's a representation, R is an atomic mental representation, then R represents natural kind or property K, if and only if members of K or instantiations of other of natural property K are more efficient in their causing of the activation of R in S than are the members of any other natural kind or property. So the idea here in general is to begin with a mental representation, cognitive representation that can be identified, at least in principle, can be identified in some other way than by its meaning. It is an attractor in a state space in a dynamical system, or it is a cluster of neurons that fire in a correlated way. Some way of describing this unit or vehicle, as I was calling it yesterday, some way of describing this that is independent of semantics or content or meaning or representational value. We identify this, and then the question is, which of the kinds or properties in the environment is most efficient in the causing of that representation, is most likely to activate it, although I'll say more about that likelihood in a minute. To be a bit more technical, the measure of efficiency is the following. It's an actual historical measure. Property K has efficiency rate relative to mental representation R and S equal to the number of times instantiations of K have caused the activation of R and S divided by the number of times instantiations of K have caused the activation of any mental representation in S. Okay, that's a mouthful. But the basic idea is that, you can ask this question whether members of a given kind, keep it simple, say horses in the environment, when horses cause the activation of a representation in my cognitive system, how often is it horse as opposed to something else? It might be that occasionally a horse in a field, in the fog, on a dark night, what have you, horse will cause the activation of cow in my cognitive system, the representation we're inclined to call cow. But you might think that most of the time when a horse causes the activation of any mental representation in my cognitive system, it will include the activation of the representation we would normally take to be horse. So you can think of this as a hypothetical process. I introduced this a moment ago as an actual historical measure, but one can think of a kind of hypothetical procedure one would go through to investigate content. Ultimately, it is the very historical facts about the subject's interaction with the environment that determine what the content of the thought is. So it's not important for anyone to ever have gone through this hypothetical process. Content will be determined by the objective or metaphysical facts about interaction. But talking about this as a hypothetical procedure or process may be a way of conveying the idea. First, one finds a representational vehicle of interest, what I'm calling R, it's my stand-in here, in the subject of interest. I'll sometimes suppress that term, the subject term, and leave it out, but we are always talking about a definite individual. Then one makes a list of all of the genuine properties and kinds in the subject's environment. One then asks the following of each property or kind. Of all the times that the investigation of that property or kind has caused the activation of a mental representation in S, what percentage of those were R's, the representation of interest? The kind or property with the winning percentage, the highest percentage, is the content of R. That's the idea behind this theory. Now, some of you may have studied probability theory, and there is a fairly clear relation here to what are known as conditional probabilities. So I will remark on that relation. If probability theory is not in your background, then you can just ignore this particular connection. If probability is understood as a past relative frequency, then this theory assigns as content R the kind with the highest probability of causing the activation of R, conditional on its activating any mental representation at all. That is, the content is K1, just to label this as a specific kind, if and only if, here's the probabilistic symbolism, capital P, open parenthesis, R conditioned on K1 activates any mental representation at all. So the probability of R, given that K1 has activated any mental representation at all. This is significantly greater than that conditional probability relative to R for any other kind or property in the subject in question. I say significantly, and that is worth remarking on. Pardon me. Because in cases where there are more than one properties or kinds that are all sort of equally efficient and they're at the top, then we have a complex representational content. If we have two kinds that are very close together at the top, for example, then we may still have a complex representational content. Sometimes we have words that have, say, two different kinds in their extension. It is, I am not a mineralogist, but it has been claimed that jade, the mineral substance, is actually two very different substances, jadeite and nephrite. But it might be that our mental representation of jade is equally sensitive to those two. And so in the content, there are kind of two winners at the top, or nearly tied at the top, not significantly separated. And so the content of jade in that case could be both nephrite and jadeite. Let me provide a simple illustration how the kind of mathematics of the theory works. Imagine horses have caused the tokening of a mental representation in S on 200 occasions, and 200 horse sightings, you might say. Keep it perceptual and stick to vision. Keep it simple. On 180 of those occasions, R was among the representations activated. So the success rate of horse, the kind, is 90% relative to R and S. Might be better for horse to be in italics, but I'll say something about that later. So the success rate of horses is 90% relative to this subject and the representation we're interested in. 180 is 90% of 200 occasions. Cows have caused the tokening of a mental representation in S on 300 occasions. On 15 of those occasions, R was among the representation activated. So in this case, we have more cow sightings than there have been horse sightings, but that does not matter. What's relevant is that we calculate this efficiency rate for cows. How good are they at causing the activation of the representation we're interested in? On 15 of those occasions, R was among the representations activated. So the success rate of cow is 5% relative to R and S. 15 is 5% of 300. And to be realistic, a little more realistic, we might want to allow that some other kinds have caused the activation of R and S. But imagine those success rates are all very low. Occasionally, a pig gets mistaken for a cow, as we might normally speak. But that is very rare. So horse is the clear winner, 90% versus 5% versus some other very low percentages. So horse is the most efficient kind in the causing of R, and R is a horse representation. Now, I think it's easy to misunderstand some of the details here. I won't go through all of the possible misunderstandings, but I'll remark on one or two. This is not a matter of a properties being responsible for the largest percentage of activations of the representation. The content is not determined by the highest conditional probability, like the converse of what I had earlier. It's not determined by the highest conditional probability of K1 given R. among the inventory of the world's kinds and properties. In other words, to step away from the conditional probability talk, in other words, we are not simply looking at the subject's history, listing all of the times that R was activated and seeing which percentage of those is the highest, looking at the causes of all those activations and seeing what the most common cause was. We're not interested in that. It might be that most of your representations are not caused by horse. They're caused by many other things. But that's because there are lots of, we might say, false positives. There are lots of things other than horses causing R, but they don't, as individual kinds, they don't do it very often. It's only horses that, when cited, are likely to cause the activation of R. It may just be that there are very few horses in the environment. This might help. There can be an extreme case. A property might have a maximal efficiency rate relative to R. Say one, every time you see that property or kind, R gets activated. So every time it causes the activation of any representation at all, it causes the activation of R. It still may be responsible for a very small percentage of the total number of activations of R. So that latter fact, the percentage of total number of activations of R that were caused by a given kind, this is irrelevant to the property's efficiency rate relative to R. We're not asking if the R is active in the subject's mind, what's the probability of the kind being in the environment? We're not asking that. It's the opposite. If members of the kind are in the environment, what's their chance of causing the activation of R? And those are two different quantities. So in other words, what we are not doing is calculating of all the activations of R and S, the percentage of them that are caused by horse or cow or whatever kind. We are not calculating conditional probabilities of the form, probability of the kind, given that R was activated. And notice too, a separate point now, that the efficiency rate of all kinds and properties summed does not need to equal 100%. Horses might have a 90% efficient rate, while many other kinds have 5% or 10% rates. The percentage is adding up to much more than 100 if they're totaled and by simple summing. Because this isn't a matter of taking a total number of things, the activations of R in the subject, and divvying up those into percentages. This is more a matter of figuring out how good subjects are, a matter of figuring out how good kinds are at activating a given representation. So it's a bit like test scores, part of why this is called the best test theory. It's a bit like test scores. Horse can get 90%, you know, one student could get 90%, another student can get 80%, another student can get 50%. That all adds up to far more than 100%. If someone said, well, you know, that can't be right, you know, it shouldn't add up to so much, they kind of have misunderstood the idea of test scores. Similarly here. All right. What I've been describing to you is a simple principle for the most basic cases, how to take a system with no content at all. It may have innate dispositions or biases, but no content at all. And taking a brain and a child body, connected to that brain, including that brain, and you're asking how something with no content could get content into it. But surely the content of our thoughts or the content of our representations could be affected by existing content once it gets in there, once there's some content. And so I won't go on about this case, but I want to acknowledge that this is important kind of fact. So I'll give a couple of examples of how this might happen. So BTT, this basic principle, targets our most basic representations. This excludes the case in which some representational content is already fixed and used to establish new representations or refine the content of existing ones. This does not, however, exclude cases in which a representation's conditions of activation are causally mediated by other representations. So I want to be careful about that. Sometimes once a representation is in place, it can serve as a link in a causal chain, even though the content of the representation isn't what's determining the content of something farther down the causal chain. What might these most basic representations be? The ones that don't have any content fixing intentions directed toward them. Possibilities might include object, just the simple concept of an object, conspecific, animate, maybe primitive visual features. Many possibilities. I won't try to make a definite list. But I mentioned a moment ago that once representation is in at the basic level, it can serve to affect the content of new representations or existing representations. So that's the case I want to go on and talk about, which I described a bit prematurely there. In many cases, words, for example, horse, will have the highest efficiency rate relative to a given R. The word horse may be more effective at activating my a mental representation of horses than is the visual image of horses or interacting with horses in the environment. But they may at least be equally effective and so tied together. But here's a case where the subject's intention to use language, not to mention it or to refer to it, may take this efficiency rate out of contention. So horse, the English word in this case, will not be a candidate content for the representation of R because the subject does not intend to take words as targets. Now, what form this intention could take? We'd have to go through much more detail, cognitive scientific exploration of what kinds of structures might be active. But you can imagine that early in childhood development, a child comes to represent words, that there is language and thinks about language itself. Parents will talk to children like ball is the word for balls and holds up a ball. Right? And so the child gets the idea that words are things one could think about. And that idea, as I just called it, is actually involves a mental representation of the kind word, or it's a mental representation of the intention of the child's caregivers, which is itself an objective psychological fact about the caregiver, that the caregiver intends to be using this sound in a particular way. And so you can imagine that the best test theory could apply to some representations that involve language so that we can represent language as a phenomenon, not merely use it. Once one has those representations, representations of parts of language, linguistic items, maybe the intentions of caregivers, other adults, other humans related to language use. Once the child has representations of those things, the child can form the intention in a particular case to use language generally, not to mention it or refer to it, to only mention it or refer to it in limited context. And this would alter the relevance of maybe the efficiency rate of a horse for activating a given representation. Consider also intentions to defer to experts. So this is a more positive intention rather than a negative one. A subject might have a representation of the kind proton. I may be able to think about protons, but be in no position to interact specifically with protons because they aren't chemists, they don't work in a high energy physics lab, they don't have any way of being specially sensitive to protons. But so long as the subject has such concepts as representation, can represent words, and the subject can intend that her proton representation have whatever content is had by the mental representation that produces experts' utterances of protons. The simple idea here that would have to be executed by the cognitive system and maybe in ways that aren't accessible to consciousness. But the simple idea is to say, I don't exactly know what a protein is or a DNA strand is or use some other technical concept or scientific concept. I don't exactly know what a proton is, but I want my proton concept to mean what the experts mean. And so that would be a way of, sometimes it's called borrowing mental content. And an intention would be behind that. That intention, though, would have to have its content already fixed. And so some parts of that intention then may be subject to the BTT's basic principle. For example, when I think about experts, I'm thinking of other humans. The representation of other humans may be something that develops very early by BTT's basic principle. So I want to go on now and talk about some of the advantages of the view. And again, this is to kind of promote or argue in favor of BTT itself, but also to give you some sense of what naturalistic semanticists have kind of concerned themselves with when they formulate and develop these kinds of theories. So the best test theory allows for misrepresentation. It seems very important. It solves something called the qua problem, which I will describe momentarily. It fits nicely with theories of development. So I'll say a bit more about development and why the best test theory seems to jibe well with our understanding of development. And it grounds a plausibly moderate nativism. We can say that some concepts are innate, but it's a very moderate version of innateness. It still requires epigenesis, as it's sometimes called, interaction with the environment in order for content to be fixed. All right, so I'll walk through these four topics. Misrepresentation. We might expect any theory of representation to account for the phenomenon of misrepresentation or representational error. That would seem to explain many of what we would naturally refer to as failed or inappropriate instances of behavior. When someone, to be a bit ridiculous, when someone puts a saddle on a cow and can't ride and can't get anywhere, we think, ah, well, that seems like a failed behavior. They're not getting what they want. And one way to explain that sort of failure is to appeal to misrepresentation. Maybe they mistook the cow for a horse. The best test theory accounts for misrepresentation by its comparative measure. Instantiations of properties that do not have the highest efficiency rate with regard to a given mental representation do sometimes cause the activation of that representation. And these are misrepresentations. In my simple example earlier, horses had a 90% efficiency rate relative to R, the representation we've chosen. Cows had a 5% efficiency rate. 5% of the times cows caused any representation to be active, it was horse. Maybe in reality, for a real person, it would be significantly lower than that even. Nevertheless, cows can sometimes cause the activation of R, the thing that horses are very good at activating. And so when, on those occasions, a cow does cause the activation of R, it is a misrepresentation because cows are not the winners. They did not have the highest efficiency rate, not even close. So we have misrepresentation. Now, part of this idea here, I wonder if I can, I'm going to skip that slide for now. It overlaps with some things I said yesterday and it may not be so important at this juncture. Let me talk about the qua problem then. That was the second thing on my list of advantages of the theory. Now, one thing to notice is that an object that causes the activation of R might instantiate more than one property. For example, a lion is a lion. It's also a feline, a mammal, and an animal. So on a simple causal view, it would seem indeterminate which of those properties counts as the one represented by a representation activated in response to a lion. You might think all of the properties are at least potentially statistically relevant. So how do we sort this out? So statistical relevance pertains to the best test theory. The simple causal view is one that I've discussed before. It's just this simple idea that a representation is a representation of whatever causes it. In this case, the thing that's doing the causing is a lion, but it's also a feline and a mammal and an animal. So which thing is the representation or representation of? Is it a representation of lions or of felines or of mammals or of animals? It seems indeterminate. There's no way to decide. BTT brings in questions of statistical relevance. We can ask, of all these properties, whether they're statistically relevant, and more specifically, which one wins in the competition kind of set up by BTT. All right, well, it depends a bit on what kind of competition there is. So I'll talk here about competition from above and competition from below. If there's a representation that would seem to be a representation of lions, then when we ask, why isn't it a representation of mammals, or why isn't it a representation of animals, then we're asking about competition from above, a more inclusive category, a category higher in the, in this case, in the network of genus and species. If lion is the correct content assignment to R, how does BTT deliver that result? More generally, how does BTT single out a property in circumstances like this? Consider animal. This is competition from above. Of all the times animals cause the activation of one of the typical subject's terms, only a small proportion will be lion, where lion is the term now, not the kind. So I think I've used these terms set all in capital letters, sometimes for the conceptual units and sometimes for the kind in the world. So I'll try to make it clear in context, which is which. So here, consider animal the kind, so animals in the world. Of all the time animals cause the activation of one of the typical subject's terms, only a small proportion will be the representation line. Animals cause all kinds of other terms, pig, horse, dog, which brings their efficiency rate down relative to lion. Because remember, the efficiency rate is a question about sort of how likely the kinds are to cause the activation of this representation. Animal is, you know, if you think about all the animals in the environment and say how likely are, you know, all of them taken as a group to cause the activation of lion, that will be very low because many of the animals are not lions and they won't be mistaken as lions. So it's a matter of this overall pattern of causal relations, not a question about what properties were present on a given occasion. So in this case, BTT solves the problem easily. Competition from above is a very easy kind of case. But the qua problem takes two forms. The other form involves competition from below. Sometimes we want a representation to be a representation of a higher level category like animal or mammal, not something more specific like lion. So how can that assignment be made by BTT? Assume the correct content assignment for the representation is, say, mammal. The efficiency rate of lions with respect to mammals, the kind, will plot, the efficiency rate of lions with respect to mammal, the representation, will plausibly be just as high as the efficiency rate of mammals with respect to mammal. Okay, let me try to make that clear. Right? So you might think that a term mammal, or the representation that refers to mammals, is caused efficiently by mammals, but you might think it's caused just as efficiently by lions. You know, you might think all of the mammals are pretty good at causing mammal. So lions will be good at causing mammal, and horses will be good at causing mammal, and so on. So why say that the reference of mammal is just sort of mammals? Why say that the representational content of the internal representation we're inclined to think of as mammal is just mammals? After all, every time a lion causes the activation of any term at all, any representation, at least one of them will plausibly be the representation mammal. So why isn't the content of mammal actually lions? How does this get resolved? I think this brings up some interesting facts, some possible solutions. The psychological details matter. It might be that the activation of mammal by lions is only weak priming related activation. The idea of priming is that a subject's exposure to an image or a word, something in the environment, can have for a short time a subconscious effect of biasing the subject's further cognition. Perhaps the subject is exposed to a discussion about money or an image of money. And so in a sentence that's heard as stimulus shortly after, that includes the word bank in an ambiguous way. That could be a river bank, the side of a river, or it could be a bank as a financial institution. Subjects are more likely in those circumstances to disambiguate the sentence, to resolve the ambiguity in favor of financial institution, because they were primed to do so. Kind of idea of a financial institution was activated by a preceding discussion of money or an image of money. But you might think that the very weak priming related activation of a representation isn't activation enough. So in that case, it may be plausible that many of the times lions cause the activation of any representation at all in the subject, mammal is not among them. Full-blown activation of mammal, the representation, in response to lions, might occur only in situations that cause inferential processes to be engaged. For example, when asked an explicit question about the categories lions fall into. In that case, it might be that mammals have a fairly low efficiency rate relative to mammal. But nevertheless, it will be higher than other efficiency rates. I say this last bit because if lions often cause only a weak version or a weak level of activation of a representation, one that doesn't count as full-blown activation, then that will be true of other mammals as well. And so you might have a fairly low activation rate of the representation mammal by mammals, but it may still be higher than the rate for any individual kind, any individual type of mammal, like lion. It's a sort of a nicety, I guess I included it here partly to illustrate the idea that it could be that the winner of BTT's competition, so to speak, the winner doesn't have a particularly high efficiency rate. It might not be 90% like it was in my example of the horses. Nevertheless, it still could be higher than, significantly higher than all of the competitors. Now, this approach might be especially relevant in early development when kids are responsive primarily to basic level categories. Categories seem to break down roughly into superordinate kinds, such as animal, subordinate kinds, such as German Shepherd, and intermediate or basic level kinds, such as dog. Much work in the 1970s was done by Eleanor Roche on this topic. It was very influential. Intermediate level kinds take primacy in thought in many contexts, and particularly developmentally, as reflected in the order of acquisition of nouns in children. They acquire terms for intermediate level kinds before they acquire terms for the higher level kinds or the very specific kinds. But really, a more straightforward solution, which doesn't involve all these questions about level of activation and whether lions sometimes activate mammal and sometimes don't, just much more straightforward solution applies in the case of a tie at the top or a virtual tie. If lions and mammals are in a virtual tie at the top relative to the representation mammal, the two following content assignments are equivalent, mammals and lions, because mammals include lions. Right? So if you just think of it from the standpoint of what's sometimes called the extension of a term, the collection of things the term properly applies to, then sort of the question about kind of lumping lions and mammals together becomes kind of irrelevant, because then, you know, when you have the group of mammals and you add the lions to it, you really haven't added anything at all. The lions were already in there. So if representational content is an abstraction from the collection of things represented, being a mammal is the sole winner because the set of mammals includes the set of lions. There's many other things as well. So the property shared by all of the concrete things represented is that of being a mammal, the common property shared by all of the things whose kinds have high efficiency rates, the highest ones at the top, is being a mammal. So that seems to solve the representation from above. I think content fixing intentions might also do some work here, but we'll skip over those to try to stick to a limited number of substantial points. Representational vehicles are of interest for the reason, for developmental reasons. So I made a list earlier of four advantages of BTT, and the latter two, one having to do with development and one having to do with innateness, which are closely tied together. Both are at least indirectly questions about representational vehicles. So any theory of representation in humans should jibe with our best theory of the appearance of representational vehicles. The units that have representational content and that participate in the physical processing that produces intelligent behavior. A naturalist will want to find something that carries the mental content. And that's the idea of carrying is behind the choice of this term vehicle. In the kind of computational context, you think of data structures. The data structure can be characterized independently of its content. And then that would be a vehicle that carries content, that participates in processing itself. But where do these come from? Well, at least in broad strokes, BTT's basic principle accords well with going theories of the relevant aspects of development, the appearance of these representational vehicles. I say theories plural because I want to mention a few different ones and just show that in all of the cases, the approach to content that's taken by BTT is kind of friendly to each of these theories. So kind of regardless of which one of these theories you would accept or you think is ultimately correct, BTT seems to be in good standing. That's something wrong here. Just a sec. All right. So the general vision, the general concept, is that the vehicles of mental representation must become functional. They are work shaped out of materials that are present, but they have to be sort of made into units that can participate in processing. So they are not present at birth. And although the neural system might be biased in certain respects, the appearance of specific vehicles depends heavily on interaction with the environment. The processes of interaction that shape the vehicles, turning them into functional units rather than snippets of noise or transitory states, are simultaneously processes of interaction that fix representation according to BTT's basic principle. There is a converging history, you might say. Lots of historical interaction I don't mean historical in the grand sense, I mean in the actual biography of the individual subject. Lots of historical interaction is required in order for functional neural vehicles or other kinds of vehicles, I should say, to appear. And much of this involves interaction with the very kinds of properties that the vehicles in question come to represent. This greatly increases the plausibility of an actual historical measure as a theory of content. It's, you know, it's an interesting convergence. Some things are shaped in ways that don't give content to the things, right? So it might be that the potter's hands working to make a ceramic pot shape that pot, but the pot doesn't therefore come to be a representation of the hand or a representation of the maker, except perhaps metaphorically. What I'm claiming here is that there is a deeply convergent history, that the only way to get vehicles to become like cognitively functioning units is for interaction with the environment. And that interaction, the shaping of those vehicles by that interaction, is simultaneously the process that gives those vehicles their content. So consider neurobiological approaches to the introduction of content. There are two major contenders in the neurobiological domain. One contender is selectionist theories. According to a selectionist theory, there is generation followed by experience-dependent pruning, which creates, functional neural structure. So children are born with many more synapses, and in fact, many more neurons than there will eventually be in the brain. There is a very strong process of pruning that's dependent on experience, that leaves the sort of functional synapses in place, but lets others die, so to speak. Sometimes entire neurons die, sometimes only interfaces with other neurons. On the other hand, there are constructivist theories according to which the structure of the input can cause the generation of the very resources subsequently used to solve the problems of interacting with that input. So you can get the creation of new dendritic branches, for example, or denser collections of synaptic channels. So just to make clear the point of that. So in both cases, in order to get to the point where the cognitive system is functioning using the units in question, a process of interaction with the environment must occur first. Either the selectionist process of experience-dependent pruning, where experience strengthens some relations and lets other ones die, or the constructivist process of having the input differentially cause new growth, new growth will then make some units more functional than others, make them capable of participating in thought processes. Okay. Both of those processes involve interaction with the environment. I'm claiming that's the same kind of interaction that can cause the fixation of content. Computational systems are a different kind of case, not thinking so much about the neurons here, but think about computational systems. Even computational systems as models of human cognition require the introduction of vehicles. It is an idealization that the cognitive system comes into place, comes into existence with a stock of primitive representations in place. Computationalists might say that the formation of vehicles is outside their domain of study, but the vehicles must appear somehow. Now, this point is related deeply to a point that is frequently made or has been frequently made in the embodiment literature. In their classic book on embodied cognition, Varela, Thompson, and Roche use the metaphor of sort of parachuting into the world with representations fully formed. And they derided that idea, criticized it. And the point, I think, that was bothering them is that when computational theorists present their models, they simply lay down a list of primitive representations. They say the computational system has a stock of terms that can refer to individuals, such as small case A, B, C, D. Right? They just kind of stipulate the stock of representations available. And that seems very unrealistic, at least if a computational model is going to apply to a human being, those representations have to have come from somewhere. And to be fair, some computationally oriented theorists have recognized this, Zenon Polition, for example, in the 80s. Moreover, most computationalists will want a semantics for computational vehicles. So this is another thing they typically stipulate in their models. They'll just say, here are a fundamental stock of units, and here's what they refer to, right? But they need a theory. So it may be attractive to them to appeal to the converging history of vehicle introduction or appearance and content fixing relative frequencies in keeping with BTT. Now, if one is Chomsky or the person we were talking about yesterday, Francis Egan, one might not be so interested in a semantics for those vehicles, but it seems like they will need some semantics. In Chomsky's case, these vehicles may need to refer to syntactic types, at least noun, verb, subject, verb, object, things like that. All right, dynamical systems theory is another relevant approach to development. Dynamical systems theory depicts cognitive development as the experience-dependent shaping of the brain's or entire body's phase space. Now, I'm not sure about the level of expertise that the audience has in dynamical systems theory. I cannot here present a tutorial on the kind of dynamics the way differential equations, function and the way they're applied to the analysis of dynamical systems, all those sorts of details. But the basic idea is that when one characterizes a system, one can create a representation of all the possible states that system can be in. And then one can, within that space, it would be a multidimensional space. Within that multidimensional space, one can make a kind of picture based on the probability of transition from any one point in that space to another. Now, a very simple case might be a binary light switch, which has only two possible states. The light switch is either on or off. And so in the case of the light switch, the state space is very simple. It's a single dimension with two points in it. It's in and of itself, it's got no dynamics really, unless someone flips the switch, brings in external forces, the switch will simply stay in the position that it's in. So it's very boring a system to analyze dynamically. The brain, on the other hand, may have a massively dimensioned state space. There's a massive number of dimensions. One dimension for the activation of every neuron in the brain, you might think. So if the activation levels are all at a certain level, a different level for each neuron, perhaps, that can be represented by a point in the state space, you might call the space of all the possible states of the system. And then the question arises, and this is the important one, what's the probability of making a transition to any given other point? And if you make a picture of that, then you have this thing I put on the slide, the phase space. That phase space will draw kind of a picture of where the system is likely to wind up, where it's likely to go from one place to another. When there are spots that kind of attract the system from any nearby space, any nearby point in the state space, any nearby just state that the system is likely to be in or could be in, sorry, any state that the system could be in a given region of the state space may all move towards a kind of privileged point, and that would be called an attractor. I hope that some of that sounds familiar. But the point here is that cognition is a series of transitions through points in the phase space. And what that trajectory through the phase space will look like depends on the shaping of the brain or the bodily system by experience. Much of the experience in question is bodily. For the child, it involves learning to walk, say, kicking at mobiles, ballistic reaching, coming into physical contact with parents, say, by touch. Right? So interaction with the environment shapes the attractors that are most plausibly identified with vehicles of mental representation in DST models. And those attractors need to be shaped from the standpoint of dynamical systems theory to give structure to the dynamical system, so that it isn't just performing some random movement through its state space, bouncing around from one thing to another, so that there is a functional transition from one attractor to another. And the point here is that we have a converging history again. The shaping of the phase space is determined to a great extent by bodily experience involving things like kicking at mobiles and ballistic reaching and so on. Now, this has been of some interest to theorists in cognitive linguistics because the thought is that some of the fundamental bodily patterns that emerge become very important attractors in the cognitive system, attractors that can govern thought in many different areas when it comes to language use or otherwise. So there is a historical connection here between bodily based development of mental representations, as I would call them, and the development of dynamical systems based resources for thinking about schemas in cognitive linguistics. Some of you may be familiar with talk of connectionist networks. They have sometimes been called artificial neural networks, sometimes deep neural networks. Nowadays, they have been articulated and refined to give us the kind of networks that can perform machine learning nowadays in the domain of artificial intelligence. It's sometimes claimed that connectionist networks have only distributed representations. They're the representation of a house or horses or what have you. Another human is the function of the activity of many representations spread out across the network. And maybe this is biologically realistic as a representation of a human neural network. That's an open question. But many connectionist networks have local representations, at least of the micro features of the input. Even if the representation of a house is distributed across a network, there will be small representations of parts of the house, corners of the window frame, right? The things that help to identify this thing as a house. So there will be local representations, kind of identifiable local ones, maybe of kinds that we're used to talking about, maybe only of very local things. Micro features are sometimes called things like little corners, changes in the intensity of the light gradient, as we spoke of yesterday. But even in the case of distributed representations, these things will take shape over time by learning mechanisms, such as the most famous one, the backpropagation algorithm in connectionist theorizing. So the idea is that you can begin a kind of series of experiments with the connectionist network by setting some weights between different hypothetical neurons, these artificial neurons, little units in the network. But in order for the network to become functional, there has to be learning and change and shaping. And that will be dependent on activity or correction. And as a result of that, either local or distributed representations will appear in the network as a result of the, again, this interaction with the environment. And so here's another possible way in which the appearance of representational vehicles that can contribute to cognition as a historical process converges with the process of interaction with the things that will become the representational contents of those vehicles that are emerging. So setting aside differences between these approaches, BTT seems to be, they seem to, you know, show that BTT is in the right ballpark for the application of its basic principle. These different approaches involve early development at a stage at which it's unlikely that subjects direct content fixing intentions toward other mental representations. And they involve the sort of gradual shaping up of functional vehicles consonant with the stable statistical relation required for content fixation by BTT. Now, I say a stable statistical relation because there can be flukes in efficiency rates based on the subject's actual history. So we would want the pattern of activations by a given kind relative to a given representation to be stable based on a significant sample over time. So the last of the four advantages listed, it can be addressed by asking the question, are BTT's concepts innate? And I want to kind of convince you that there is a plausible weak form of nativism that BTT is kind of friendly to, lends itself to. Now, by one Fodorian standard, they are. Now, I mentioned this influential American philosopher of cognitive science, Jerry Fodor. Fodor had some very strange sounding views on innateness. At least they sound strange at first. And I will try to make you think that they are not so strange. And the not so strange version of them is the version that overlaps well with BTT. On the Fodorian view, a representation is innate if and only if it is not defined. It isn't acquired by explicit hypothesis formulation. Now, this form of innateness is very weak, and I'll make some remarks on why. But let's first make sure we understand what I mean when I say it's not defined or is not acquired by explicit hypothesis formulation. Sometimes we can acquire a representation by being given a definition. So in the one commonly used system of family relations, an aunt is someone's parent's sister. So anyone who is the sister to one of my parents is one of my aunts, Aunt Sarah, Aunt Joyce, or what have you. And that term aunt or aunt, as it's sometimes said in this context, is fully defined. So long as I know what sister is and parent is, then I can define aunt. In a way then, aunt is simply an abbreviation of a collection of concepts I already have. So Fodor says, any concept that isn't learned that way is innate. Any concept that isn't learned by that kind of explicit definition or hypothesis is innate. But that form of innateness is very weak. It allows that innate representations are not present at birth, which is good, and it allows other representations to play a causally mediating role, so long as they don't constitute definitions or explicit hypotheses about the meaning of new representations. So there lots of ways in which a new representation can appear. Fodor is just saying this one thing, that if you use an explicit hypothesis or definition, like my parent's sister is an aunt, if you do that, then the term or representation is not innate. Otherwise, it's innate in this very weak sense. Incredibly weak sort of sense of innateness. The explanation of how representations are acquired can be at least partly psychological, say when other representations causally mediate the activation of a new representation. And it's even more clearly a kind of psychological matter When psychological models are allowed to be flattened from above, as I argued they should be in my first lecture, combining factors traditionally considered psychological with other supposedly subpersonal elements, such as neurobiological factors. So I think Fodor himself was sometimes too narrow-minded. He would say, well, if there's not an explicit definition, then this process of term introduction or representation formation isn't psychological at all. It's just part of a different science or discipline. And so all that we care about in psychology has to be at the level of representations that already have their content. So the only psychological process of introducing a new representation would involve forming a definition. Otherwise, there would be some kind of non-psychological component, and that would have to be treated as a kind of innateness. But we can see that there are various ways psychological factors can affect the acquisition of another representation, particularly when existing representations causally mediate, not define, and also when psychological models are allowed to include things like the shape of the state space or other factors I was discussing when I talked about the development of vehicles. Those might be thought of as subpersonal, but they are in a sense psychological because they appear in the models that psychologists would be interested in when explaining behavior. One interesting aspect of this kind of picture that I've been presenting is the extent of its environmental and bodily contingency, something that's been of great interest in the embodied cognition literature. On this view that I've been presenting, which representations are acquired in accordance with BTT's basic principle depends heavily on contingent details of the environment and our interaction with it. Because that interaction with it will be heavily dependent on what kind of bodies we have and how those bodies enable us to interact with the environment. So assume that the universe is rich with natural properties. This seems to be true when you read the literature in physics or chemistry or whatever, you realize there are so many possible properties out there in the world. Then which of these come to be contents of our mental representations depends on the properties that our particular forms of processing are sensitive to. This dovetails nicely with the idea from the embodiment literature that the human cognitive system creates its own cognitive world, because it's really a function of the bodily capacities or the bodily possibilities that we engage consistently with certain of the properties in the environment than others. And so those properties are causing the activation of representations in us, and they can come to be the content of our representations. There may be many, many other properties out there in the universe or in our environment that we aren't bodily prepared to interact with or aren't very sensitive to. And so those simply don't become part of are the set of contents of our representations. So if we think of our cognitive world as that set of contents of our representations, then that gives you one way to make sense of the claim by Varela, Thompson, and Roche and others in the embodiment literature to make sense of their claim that we create our own cognitive world. It's also a very commonly made claim that what kind of cognition one has depends on what kind of body one has. And this is a one aspect of that claim, which I'll talk more about tomorrow. I'll finish with a couple of words about what's known as teleosemantics. It's the most prominent alternative to this kind of causal, developmental, or statistical theory I've been presenting. The general idea of teleosemantics is that the representation R represents whatever its ancestral antecedents did that allowed our ancestral organisms to flourish evolutionarily. That is, whatever the ancestral versions of R were selected for corresponding to in the environment. The standard versions of this approach are evolutionarily, so I put it that way. The idea is that my representations now did not appear in the evolutionary context. They're part of my body, and I wasn't there in the distant past. But my ancestors, earlier humans, had physical structures that were the antecedents of my representations. And so those structures contributed to the behavior of my ancestors and presumably helped my ancestors do well and survive and reproduce and get selected for, versus maybe some individuals who didn't survive and reproduce, so whose genes were removed from the gene pool. Right? So you think of this in terms of genetic or evolutionary competition, and certain genes were selected for because they produced certain phenotypes, features of the organism. And one of those features is to have a representation R, or a predecessor to that. It's the same, it's homologous is a term that might be applied here. This is very problematic, I think, because of course, the representations that I have may not be the same, even as vehicles, as my ancestors. But we'll kind of play along right now, because that's the idea. And it's very popular. This is in a Western philosophy, the most popular naturalistic theories of content are teleosemantic. So if you're looking at that literature at all, you will encounter these teleosemantic views. But why not teleosemantics? Well, from the perspective of the philosophy of cognitive science, the central problem with teleosemantics is the questionable relevance of the distant past, questionable relevance of evolutionary history. Modeling of human cognition pertains to contemporary performance, to the lives and behavior of individual humans here, not their ancestors. Cognitive scientists should be making models of the quantities relevant to the lives of humans now. I mean, quantities in a very general sense of measurements of properties that are relevant to the lives of humans now. Speculating about what a representation type might have been selected for doesn't seem to play any more of a role than possibly inspiration for a theory, but it's nothing more valuable than brainstorming maybe, but it shouldn't constrain our current theorizing. Yesterday I went on at some length about the role that a theory of representation might play in explaining behavior, what its explanatory role might be. In my simple example from yesterday, there were events earlier in a person's life that could then be used to explain events later. I met a character named John, and then I waved to John and said hello at the shopping mall a week later. So the establishing of a representation relation in that case can help to explain surprising or non-random behavior at a later time. But it's much more difficult to see how that kind of modeling is going to proceed if we're emphasizing what role a representation played, 10 million years ago. Moreover, individual development is quite flexible and dependent on the experience of the individual. It seems implausible that humans now form the same representational vehicles as their evolutionary ancestors. One of the points that's commonly made in dynamical systems theory is worth thinking about here. There's a lot of contingency in the way the individual humans phase space develops, the kind of shape that their processing takes, how likely they are to move from one place to another, and where these attractors are, where these attractor wells appear. That may be too obscure a way of putting it, but you can think about the brain, how complex and many dimensioned the brain is, It may be useful to think that you and I have the same representational vehicle, but even just across contemporary individuals, two humans now, the idea that their brain would have kind of the same vehicles in it, it almost doesn't make any sense. What does it mean for the same neuron to be active in you as is in me? There isn't a standard catalog of neurons. There are 100 billion or more, and they don't sort of all match up nicely from one person to the next. So talking about representational vehicles doesn't really even seem to make sense. Like saying, talking about the same ones, my representational vehicle now should have the content that its corresponding vehicle had in my ancestors. Well, there is no corresponding vehicle in my ancestors. They don't have the same vehicles that I have. It's such a matter of contingent activity in the environment and the way my neural system happened to start out early in development. What we're more likely to have inherited evolutionarily is a capacity to represent a system that a neural system, say, that has the capacity to introduce new representations. But in order to kind of figure out what that amounts to, how it works, what the representation relation is, we should build models that include relations existing today between individuals in the contemporary environment to see whether the positing of those relations does causal explanatory work. It's one thing to say you have the capacity to represent and you inherited this from your ancestors. That does not tell you what any particular representation represents, what its representational content is, what it's about, whether it's about cows or horses or your aunt or a spaceship. Right? It just, the evolutionary story is not going to tell you, seems like anything more than that we have the capacity. But how that capacity plays out in our lives will depend on our individual histories and interaction with the environment. And that's much of what the best test theory tries to capture. One last bit, there's some philosophers endorse teleosemantics because they're attracted to the idea that it provides norms, the proper functioning of a representing structure. And this is a very appealing idea, is that somehow evolution can tell you what a trait is for, what its purpose is. It was selected to do such and such. The eyes were selected in order to provide information about the visual, the environment. So that's what the eyes are for, providing information about the spatial environment around us, that kind of thing. So even when the distant past is set aside, they view contemporary cognitive science as an exploration of human success, which is a normative concept. And my view, this normativity, whether it's specifically related to teleosemantics or not, should really be set aside. This attraction to the idea of what something is supposed to do doesn't really have a place necessarily in cognitive science. I've repeated myself, it looks like. I've been careful to in these lectures to avoid that conception of cognitive science as being normative or success oriented. If bodily experience provides a representation of a conceptual structure, say related to force dynamics, the presence of that structure might explain further structures that develop in the human cognitive system. But there's no reason to consider any of that a success or a failure. It's simply a matter of human behavior that we behave in kind of the non-random ways we do, ways that defy the null hypothesis. And we should model those behaviors, which might involve positing a representational structure that emerged from bodily experience of force dynamics, for example. But there's nothing inherently right or wrong about it, successful or unsuccessful, even though it might be useful relative to some of our purposes. And I'm going to skip this slide. I want you, just in closing, to think about the wide range of phenomena. Look at this very last paragraph. Consider the forms of behavior listed here. Monothematic delusions, perseveration, mimicking of speech patterns and bodily movements of one's interlocutor, priming, novelty seeking, construction of semantic space, mind wandering, risk-taking behavior, varying patterns of resistance to evidence, and construction of individual identity in a social context. It's just not clear to me that any of these are particularly normative questions. It is a fact that humans tend to mimic the speech patterns and bodily movements of their interlocutors, the person they're speaking to. But I don't know why I should consider that success at a task or not. It's interesting behavior that one might not expect. It defies the null hypothesis. We should try to explain it. But bringing in normative notions of right or wrong, success and failure does not seem appropriate in wide ranges of cases, topics that cognitive science should be interested in. So this is a reason to prefer the more kind of non-normative approach of the best test theory and that approach toward cognitive science more generally. All right, I'll stop there.